This morning we began talking about the subject of faith, unwavering faith, and specifically the risk of faith. And we said that serving God may be seen in some ways as risky business, the risky business of serving God. And we said this morning that basically the conclusion of that study should have been the fact that one of the major things that is at risk in truly serving God is selfishness. And it is for that reason that a lot of people decide that serving God is too risky for them to get involved in because they don't want to run the risk of losing the things that they have become so attached to in this world. Now, selfishness is not the only thing that is at risk in serving God. It is also very true. In fact, we're going to look at some cases in the Bible this evening where something other than personal satisfaction was at risk. In fact, if we think back to the book of Hebrews, as we studied this morning, particularly chapter 11, which gives us just a very, very brief and quick view of some of the famous people in the Bible. We call Hebrews chapter 11 the Hall of Fame, or Faith's Hall of Fame, the Heroes of Faith, and other titles like that. I think in one way we do those folks a disservice in one of the ways that we regard them and their lives, and I believe Hebrews chapter 11 goes a long way at correcting some of our misunderstandings. I think maybe deep down inside we've got this idea or this feeling that the people in the Old Testament who served God and were faithful to God somehow had God's instruction and God's guidance along every single step that they made, and they never were called upon to make decisions based upon that which they knew to be God's will and their relationship with God. Rather, they just all waited for God to tell them what to do next. That's not true. That's not even remotely true. Because they, like the New Testament characters and like you and I today, had a relationship with God, and God revealed His will to them, and they were responsible in every single step of their everyday lives with pleasing God. Not that God was there saying, okay, next do that, next this, next, that never has been the way that God's worked. But sometimes I think maybe we almost assume that that's the way it was with some of the Old Testament characters. Tonight, I'd like for us to take a look at two or three cases in the Old Testament where Bible characters found themselves in a situation where they had to make some decisions without a specific, thus says the Lord, do this or do that. And so let's go first of all to the book of 2 Samuel. 2 Samuel chapter 10. This is really close to some really familiar territory to most of us, because 2 Samuel chapter 11 is that chapter that tells about that horrible situation of David and Bathsheba. Many commentators will say that actually the things that happened in 2 Samuel chapter 10 had a bearing on what took place in chapter 11. We'll touch on that a little bit more in just a minute. As we look at chapter 10, we find the chapter opening up with the story of a ruler of a land next to the land of Israel, an adjacent kingdom close by in proximity to King David's territory. The king of that land dies. And David, because that king had shown him kindness in the past, though we don't know exactly what it was, but we do know that that particular king was a particular enemy of King Saul, the one who ruled before David. And it's thought that maybe since he was such a hard, fast enemy of Saul, there probably were some times when David was fleeing from Saul as Saul tried to kill him, then the king of the Ammonites probably showed David kindness in that regard, maybe gave him shelter or maybe gave him some refuge. We don't know. The Bible doesn't tell us, but it just tells us here in the opening of chapter 10 that the king of the Ammonites died, and his son ruled or came to the throne in his place. And David decided to send a group of men to show his kindness and to express his his condolences to the son whose father had died. And David sent some of his servants to console him. Verse 2. And when David's servants got to the land of the Ammonites, those who advised the new king said, "Don't think for a minute that these people from David are coming to express their condolences. What they're doing is coming to spy out the land so that they can see how hard it's going to be for David now to take over our nation, our territory." And so Hanun, that was the name of the ruler whose father had died, Hanun took David's servants, verse 4, and shaved off half their beards and cut off their garments in the middle as far as their hips and sent them away. Now, understanding the practices and the culture of that day, this was the greatest insult that could ever be given to these men. To shave off half their beards and to cut their clothing away on one side all the way down and sent them back home. When David heard of this, he sent to meet them, and the men were greatly humiliated, and the king said, "Stay at Jericho until your beards grow and then return." And verse 6 kind of sets the stage for what's about to happen. Verse 6, reading the New American Standard Version, says, "Now when the sons of Ammon saw that they had become odious to David." You know what that means? The King James Version renders that "when they saw that they stank to David." In other words, it's a phrase that's used to convey the deepest sense of disgust that you could ever have for someone. So when they saw that they were odious to David, they sent and hired the Arameans, the Syrians, from a couple of different places. We don't have PowerPoint tonight except for the fact that I want to call up a map. You can see there, this is the kingdom of Israel that's outlined and in the lighter color there all the way around. And here is the territory of Ammon, the Ammonites that have made themselves odious to David. When they realized what they had done, they sent and hired the Arameans or the Syrians from a couple of different places. Now, here's Jerusalem right here. There's where the throne city is. And of course, you recognize all of the other territory there. Up the north would be Nazareth in the New Testament context and so forth. So they've hired the Arameans or the Syrians to come and help defend them against David because they have offended David so deeply. And when David heard of it, he sent Joab, and all the army, the mighty men. The sons of Ammon came out and drew up in battle array at the entrance of the city, while the Arameans of Zobah and Rehob and the men of Tob and Maacah were by themselves in the field. Now, where we really want to focus in begins here at verse 9. We're going to read something here about Joab, and I got to tell you this about Joab. Old Joab, bless his heart, you know, we're usually pretty hard on the old guy. Joab was a rough character. There was a lot about him that was hard and coarse, but you know, he was a good leader of men. He obviously was a great commander of David's army. He and his two brothers, Abishai and Benaiah, the three sons of Zeruiah that David often referred to as giving him so much grief on occasions. But Joab was David's chief of staff. He was the chief of the army. And Joab says something and does something here that may be a little bit out of character, at least out of keeping with what we normally assume his character to be. When Joab saw the battle was set against him in front and in the rear, he selected from all the choice men of Israel and arrayed them against the Arameans. But the remainder of the people he placed in the hand of Abishai, his brother, and he arrayed them against the sons of Ammon. He said, "If the Arameans are too strong for me, then you shall help me. But if the sons of Ammon are too strong for you, then I'll come and help you." Here's the situation. The army of Israel is basically surrounded, at least on two different fronts, by two different armies. And so Joab says, "I'm going to deal with these people on this flank, and if they get too strong against me, you back me up. But if those folks over there that you're going to deal with become too strong, then I'll come help you." And then notice what Joab says in verse 12. "Be strong, and let us show ourselves courageous for the sake of our people and for the cities of our God. And may the Lord do what is good in his sight." Now I want to suggest to you that there are plenty of occasions in your life and mine when our first response really needs to be, "May the Lord do what is good in his sight." Because I believe we, and when I say we, I'm talking about me first and then everybody else also. There are so many occasions when we spend way too much time trying to figure out what God needs to do and make sure that God does his part, when we need to be doing our part and then say, "May the Lord do what is good in his sight." Well, the story has a happy ending, so to speak. Everything turned out well because Joab and the host of Israel prevailed against all of these enemies. In fact, it turned into a long-term siege against one of the cities, and commentators say that that's probably where Joab and the army was in chapter 11, when David decided for whatever reason to stay home instead of going out with the army. But chapter 10 ends with the fact that the Arameans fled before Israel. David killed 700 charioteers of the Arameans and 40,000 horsemen and struck down Shobach, the commander of their army, and he died there. And when all the kings and servants of Hadadezer saw that they were defeated by Israel, they made peace with Israel and served them, and the Arameans feared to come and help the sons of Ammon anymore. Important lesson learned on the part of several people. But God's people were victorious. What we want to focus on, though, is that statement that Joab made. You see, obviously, Joab was not following a step-by-step battle plan from the Lord. there were occasions when David would say to the priest, inquire of the Lord, shall I attack or shall we go after the Philistines? Shall we do this or shall we do that? Doesn't seem to have been the case here. Joab was doing what he knew best and filling in the gaps with, may the Lord do what is good in his sight. As I say, there are plenty of opportunities in our lives to have that attitude. In fact, we need to always have that attitude. It just really needs to come out on certain occasions when we spend so much time trying to orchestrate what we think God needs to do. May the Lord do what is good in his sight. Next, I want us to take a look at another situation that's, well, it's quite different from this. Turn with me over to Daniel chapter 3. This is really going to be a familiar story to a lot of our young folks because they've studied this in class just recently. In fact, somebody came to me with a question related to this story, and I'm going to try to answer that question the best I can as we discuss this situation. But what we've got is the nation of God's people have been taken into Babylonian captivity. And Daniel, along with at least three companions who are named, there were many others, but they're not named, but the three that are named are Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Daniel chapter 1 describes the process that Daniel went through as he made it known that he was not going to eat the food of the king's table. Chapter 2 tells about Daniel interpreting the dream of King Nebuchadnezzar, the dream that had gotten away from Nebuchadnezzar and the dream that could not be interpreted by any of the magicians in the land of the Chaldeans. In fact, it was such a big deal that Nebuchadnezzar sent forth the word and said all the magicians and dream interpreters and soothsayers in the entire kingdom need to be put to death. And it was on the occasion of that when Daniel heard about this and he said, what's going on? And he sent word to the king and he says, give me an opportunity to interpret this dream. And he interpreted that dream of the king there in Daniel chapter 2. And near the end of the chapter, it says that Daniel was elevated to a position of high authority. And Daniel requested that his three companions, his three friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that was their Babylonian names, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah were their Jewish names. But they're always referred to as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They were also put in places of authority. And then we come to chapter 3. It's really very difficult to exactly date most any given chapter in the Bible, but commentators will often say that chapter 3 describes something that takes place maybe after the Israelites had been there in the land of the Babylonians for maybe as much as 20 years. At any rate, in this chapter, King Nebuchadnezzar has this grand image of himself erected. It's about 90 feet tall and 9 or 10 feet wide. It's a huge, monstrous thing. And he sends forth a decree that at any time, whenever a certain kind of music is played publicly, then everybody is to fall down and worship this image of Nebuchadnezzar. And it turns out that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refused to fall down and worship this image. And somebody turned them in. Now, the question that's been given to me is, why is Daniel left out of this chapter? Why do we not have Daniel at the forefront of this story? Why, where was he when this music was played? Did he fall down in worship and he didn't get into trouble therefore? Did he bow to the king's image? I think the answer to that question is seen in the fact that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were reported. They were specifically turned in for not falling down and worshiping the image. Daniel is left out of the story, but that should not cause us to assume that Daniel was worshiping the image. If we're going to assume anything based on what we know about the character of Daniel, let's assume that nobody knew that Daniel was not worshiping the image, or that he was in a place removed from the oversight of these others. For whatever reason, Daniel was not involved in this story. And so Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were brought in before the king. They were reported as having not worshiped the king's gods, serving your gods, or worshiping the golden image which you have set up. And verse 13 says of Daniel chapter 3 that King Nebuchadnezzar went into a rage of anger. And in his rage of anger, he commanded that a fiery furnace be prepared and that these men be thrown into it. And he gives them an opportunity to come around. Here's what he says. Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I've set up? Now, if you are ready, at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, flute, lyre, trigon, psaltery, and bagpipe, and all the kinds of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, very well. But if you do not worship, you will immediately be cast into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire. And what God is there that can deliver you out of my hands? Verse 16 records the answer that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego gave to King Nebuchadnezzar. O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this matter. In other words, we don't need to think about what you've just told us. We don't need to reconsider. We don't need to get our heads together and say, hey, is this the best plan? Why don't we just go ahead and give in to him? We don't need to do that. That's not necessary. If it be so, our God, whom we serve, is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire. And he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. Now look at verse 18. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. Does it sound like these guys have God whispering in their ear saying, okay, now you're going to be brought in before him and just stay strong because I'll deliver you? No, that's not what happened. That's God wasn't there talking to them through this whole thing and leading them. They said, we're not going to fall down and worship your image. God will deliver us. And if God does not deliver us, we're still not going to worship your image. What does that translate to? That translates to one of the risks of faith. They were willing to risk their lives. Even if God does not deliver us, we still will not worship your God. In the case of Joab, back in 2 Samuel chapter 10, there was the risk of faith as well. There was the risk of death. There was the risk of defeat. Because Joab's faith led him to say, we're going to leave this in God's hands. We're going to do our very best and we're going to leave the rest of it up to God. There's part of the risk of faith. There's one more I want you to look at with me. And we're going to turn backward in the Old Testament now. We're actually going forward in time, but we're going to go backward to the book of Esther. If you need a little help, the book of Esther is right there before the book of Job. I don't mean to be offensive to anybody, but sometimes, you know, a shortcut is helpful. If you can find Job, Psalms, Proverbs, Esther is right there before they are. Now, you know the story of Esther as well. The story of Esther generally takes place in the same basic time period as the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, though probably several years later into the captivity. In fact, the Babylonians are no longer in power. The Medes and the Medo-Persian Empire has conquered the Babylonians and inherited all of these Israelite exiles. And in a very interesting story. In fact, if you'll take some time to read through the book of Esther, start to finish again, I know you have already, but if you'll read it again, you'll find it again a very interesting story. There are some things about it that are a little bit unusual. One is God's never mentioned in the entire book by name. But he's on nearly every page in the story in principle. His name is never called, but it's obvious that the Jews are worshipers of God. Another thing about the book of Esther that makes it sometimes difficult to study is that it is very deeply intertwined and laced up with Persian custom and practice. In fact, there are some things in this book that we don't really completely understand insofar as exactly what the process was for choosing Esther, who was a Jewess, to be the queen with King Ahasuerus. A lot of questions are kind of tough to answer. Don't get lost in those things. Keep your focus on the story, the theme of the book as you read through. But it's the story of Esther, a young Jewish lady whose mother and father were no longer alive. She had been basically adopted by a man that we often refer to as her uncle, but in the way the New American Standard describes it, it appears that they were probably cousins. Mordecai was probably many years older than Esther was, and Mordecai was basically her foster father. And the story of Esther is the story of her becoming the queen, and also the story of Mordecai, her kinsman, doing a very heroic thing, reporting a group of men who were planning to assassinate the king so that Mordecai's name went down in the record books of the Medo-Persian Empire and would later be discovered. The story is even made more intense by the character Haman. Haman was an Agagite. Makes us wonder if he was a descendant of old King Agag, whom Samuel hewed to pieces after King Saul had brought him back as a hostage in 1 Samuel 15 when God said, "Go and utterly destroy all of the Amalekites," and he brought back King Agag and many of the animals and so forth, the best of the spoils. Anyway, Haman, who occurs in this story, is the right-hand man, so to speak, of the king. And Haman hates the Jewish people who are living in the empire. And Haman cooks up a scheme and gets the king to sign off on it, to completely kill, exterminate all of the Jewish people who are living in the Babylon or the Persian Empire. When Mordecai and Esther learn of this, they are distraught. And Mordecai tells Esther, "You've got to approach the king and tell him about this. Tell him that these are your people." It appears that no one outside of Mordecai and Esther knew that she was really a Jewish girl. And Esther had a real dilemma, because according to the law of the Medes and Persians, anybody who walked into the king's presence uninvited was subject to immediately being put to death. That included the queen. That included anybody who came in, regardless of their position. That was a part of the law. The exception to that could be made on a case-by-case basis by the king himself. When the person walked into the king's presence uninvited, he could either have them taken away and killed, or he could extend his golden scepter to them and allow them to touch the tip of it. And Esther is faced with the dilemma, not being able to approach the king in any other way. She has no other choice but to go into the king's chamber uninvited. And I want you to notice what Esther says as she meets with Mordecai and talks about this situation, and she asks Mordecai to assemble all the Jews who are found in Susa, the city where they are, and fast for me. Commentators say that this request would be equivalent to us asking a group of people to gather for the special purpose of praying for us. She says, "Get all of them together and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maidens will also fast in the same way, and thus I will go into the king, which is not according to the law." That's like us saying, "which is totally illegal." "I will go into the king, which is not according to the law, and if I perish, I perish." There's the risk of faith coming up again. If I perish, I perish. Let's all fast and pray. Let's ask for God's help in whatever way He decides to give it. And if I die in this effort, so be it. I want to suggest to you that I don't think there is a more courageous person represented in the Old Testament story than the character of Esther. Well, you know how the story ends. She is received by the king, invites him to a banquet along with Haman. And at that banquet, she invites the king and Haman to a second banquet. But in the meantime, the king wakes up in the middle of the night and he's thinking about things, and he thinks back to that time when someone had turned in some guys who were planning to assassinate him. And he says, "I wonder what we ever did for that guy who foiled that plot." And so he calls in his aides and scribes and so forth, and he says, "Look back in the record of the law and the historical record and tell me, what did we ever do for that guy who saved my life?" And they said, "We didn't do anything." He said, "Who is that man?" It was Mordecai the Jew. And so the king says, "Haman, come here." Haman, I got a question for you. If I wanted to honor somebody as much as anybody in the whole land, what should be done for that man that I want to honor in such a supreme way? And old Haman thinks immediately, I finally got my hour now. The king has finally recognized what a great man I am in the kingdom. Oh, king, I think you ought to have a special horse brought around, one of your horses, and put him on it and put royal robes on him and lead him through the city. And the king says, good idea, Haman. Let's do that. I'm talking about Mordecai the Jew. And you know, in a little way, I think old Haman died a little bit right there. At least a lot of his self-importance died on that occasion. Because you see, Haman had built a gallows in his own backyard, 50 feet tall, for the express purpose of hanging Mordecai the Jew. Well, you know the rest of the story. Haman was ordered to be taken away and killed by the king. The Jews became appreciated. A few years later, Cyrus, king of Persia, sent out that decree that allowed the Jews to go back to their homeland, and God's people were spared. But Esther said, I'll do all that I can do, and in effect, I'll leave the rest of it up to God. If it kills me, it kills me. If I perish, I perish. Again, there's plenty of room in our lives for that kind of attitude. The risk of faith. Serving God is not without its risks. And I think that's been brought out to us by these stories. These old, familiar, simple stories that we've heard and told and taught over and over and over. How faithful are you? It doesn't really matter how faithful I think you are. How faithful does God say you are? If you're not faithful to God, let's do something about that. If you've never obeyed the gospel, do that before it's too late. If you have obeyed the gospel but have become unfaithful in your service to God, come back. If you're subject to His invitation in any way, we invite you to respond as we stand and sing.